At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here, early! Right now at Wayfair, get up to 70% off everything you need for the season ahead. Save on kitchen and dining, bedroom furniture and mattresses, holiday decor, and way more. Now is the time to score big, from seasonal finds to favorites you'll use all year long. Plus, with Wayfair, enjoy fast and easy shipping, with delivery in time for the holidays. Save up to 70% off early Black Friday deals. Shop now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
It is time to review day 8 of the trial of Karen Reed. Day 8 was the 2nd of May, 2025, and it was the kind of cross-examination that should have come with a warning label. By the time the defense attorney, Alan Jackson, finally stepped away from the podium, Jennifer McCabe had been through the legal equivalent of a high-speed crash, accusations flying, intentions questioned, timelines picked apart. But here's the thing. For all the fire and fury in that courtroom on May 2nd, what Jackson delivered wasn't exactly the kind of takedown the defense might have hoped for. Because when you strip away the tone, the drama, and the insinuation, what you're left with is a witness who didn't waver on the facts that mattered, and a defense strategy increasingly dependent on smoke rather than substance. I'm Tony Bruschi. Be sure to tell me what you think about this case in the comments, what you think about day 8. Yes, we can certainly disagree. There is nothing wrong with that. All we ask is that your comments make sense, that they're not just a bunch of, she's innocent, she's guilty, free Karen Reed, lock her up. But okay, give me a little substance here. Thoughts, why do you disagree? Why do you agree? That's how we learn. That's how we communicate. We're not 7-year-olds here. I know some places they are, but we don't do that. So if you want to comment, that's the only caveat to it. Do it on the YouTube page. If you're listening to the podcast, wherever you're at, be sure to press subscribe there. And yeah, please check out our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, so you can join into that conversation. So the morning opened with Jackson right where he left off the day before, going after Jennifer McCabe like she was the keynote in some grand conspiracy. He led with intensity, and he stayed there. His theory? That McCabe wasn't just a witness, but part of an elaborate plot to frame Karen Reed for the death of Boston police officer John O'Keefe. And to hear Jackson tell it, McCabe's every move, from who she called to where she stood and when she cried, was all part of a cover-up. It started with a series of pointed questions about the moment O'Keefe's body was discovered. Jackson zeroed in on McCabe's behavior when she, Karen Reed, and Kerry Roberts arrived outside 34 Fairview Road. Specifically, he wanted to know why McCabe didn't immediately run into her sister Nicole Elbert's house for help, given that Nicole and her husband Brian were both inside. Jackson hammered away, suggesting that anyone in their right mind would have
sprinted for help,
especially knowing that Brian Albert was a trained first responder. You knew John O'Keefe was clinging to life during those precious minutes and seconds. Isn't that right? He asked. McCabe visibly rattled, but steady answered yes. Once she was over there, she knew he was not in a good place. She did know. But then came the pivot, and she didn't go inside because you already knew what happened, didn't you? Now, here's where reality kicks in. McCabe didn't say she had any idea what had happened to O'Keefe. She didn't suggest foul play. She didn't jump to conclusions. What she did do, according to both her testimony and what's visible in the evidence, was focus on the man laying unresponsive in the snow. That's not suspicious. That's human. Anyone who's ever seen someone hurt knows that sometimes, in those chaotic moments, your instincts lack in what's right in front of you. McCabe said she was scared, panicked, and focused on John. Frankly, nothing about her behavior contradicts that. Jackson tried to make her hesitation seem calculated. But he didn't offer evidence that she knew anything more than what was unfolding in real time. He didn't produce a text, a call, a whisper from a witness that said she was covering something up. Just an implication that because she didn't act exactly how he thinks she should have, she must have something to hide. It's a dangerous stretch when you're talking about a woman watching a friend die in front of her, or in the reality being he was already dead and she knew it. Not because she had anything to do with it, because you could look at John O'Keefe, you could feel John O'Keefe, and you could see that he was no longer there. Then Jackson moved to her phone records, honing in on several unanswered calls McCabe made to O'Keefe in the early morning hours. He suggested those calls weren't accidental. They, as she claimed, but there were some coordinated smokescreen. But again, here's what's actually on the record. Those calls happened while McCabe, Reed, and Roberts were looking for O'Keefe, trying to retrace steps and figure out where he could have gone. She testified they were accidental, what people call butt dials. And whether or not you buy that, the idea that proves anything close to collusion is a bit of a stretch. They call the person they're looking for, even when they don't realize they're doing it. It's not a crime. It seems to be a glitch in human behavior. Does it seem a little odd to say butt dials? I'll give you that. But none of the behavior or evidence points to Jen McCabe suddenly being a cold-hearted killer, faking concern for her friend, going out and searching for him with Karen Reed, finding the body, and being like, well, you discovered my crime. Oh, no. I better act like nothing's up. They did all this in the middle of the night. They planned this from normal life to killers that can cover up crimes for 2 years. A whole group of people. Anyway, Jackson didn't stop there. He pulled up a group text thread between McCabe and others who had been at the gathering that night. In one message, McCabe wrote, "She's telling him everything," referencing Kerry Roberts talking to Trooper Michael Proctor. Jackson pounced on it, suggesting the text was evidence that McCabe and her group were trying to get their story straight. McCabe explained under oath that those texts were sent in the foggy, disoriented aftermath of discovering their friend dead in a snowbank. They weren't mapping out a conspiracy. They were just trying to understand what the hell just happened. And by the way, "she's telling him everything" sounds a lot more like panic than a strategy. One of Jackson's more aggressive tactics was to take McCabe's own words and twist them back on her. When she used the word nefarious to describe how the defense was making her actions look, Jackson practically pounced. "You're the one who brought up that word, not me," he said, as if the vocabulary choice was proof of guilt. But let's be real. When someone's being grilled for hours, accused of being at the center of a frame job, they're going to get defensive. That doesn't mean they're lying. It means they're human. Some traits that, I don't know, their defendant seems to lack. The most dramatic moments came when Jackson tried to draw blood by accusing McCabe of essentially staging the whole scene. That she knew what happened to John. That she didn't go inside because she already understood that he'd been struck by a car. When she pushed back hard, he asked if she didn't go in because she knew there was taillight next to him That's right. He suggested that McCabe had foreknowledge of forensic evidence. Somehow she planted taillight in the middle of the night. But what does she actually say? She says, I don't know. I didn't know he was hit by a vehicle and that there was taillight next to him. And there's nothing in physical evidence or testimony to contradict that. She never said she saw the taillight. She never mentioned a car. She described a traumatic scene, an injured friend, and chaos. The rest is Jackson trying to pull a rabbit out of a hat that simply isn't there. And while we're in the subject of contradictions, it's worth noting that the prosecution didn't let any of this slide in their redirect. Special Prosecutor Hank Brennan brought it right back to the facts. He reminded the jury that McCabe had told multiple people, both in text and in person, that she was sick over what happened. Not suspicious, not scheming, sick, as in horrified, as in devastated. She wasn't crafting an alibi. She was reeling from the loss of a friend. As the defense built this increasingly elaborate narrative around McCabe, they kept hoping it would stick. That they said nefarious enough times or made enough sideways comments about group texts and missed calls, the jury would stop looking at what's real. But the facts, they did not move. McCabe's story held. Her emotions were raw. Her explanations, whether you like them or not, didn't shift under pressure. And despite Jackson's best efforts, he didn't produce a smoking gun. No damning message, no secret recording. Just a witness under pressure holding her ground. When McCabe finally left the stand after three long days, she didn't look like someone who had just pulled off a high-stakes deception. She looked like someone who'd been dragged through a meat grinder for telling the truth as she remembered it. She didn't crack, she didn't confess, and most importantly, she didn't give the defense the moment they were clearly gunning for. And that matters because if Jennifer McCabe is the cornerstone of the prosecution's narrative and the defense's entire theory depends on blowing her story apart, what happens when she doesn't break? What happens when all the bluster and insinuation crashes into a wall of claim, consistent, imperfect, but real testimony? The question lingered as the prosecution moved into the next critical front in the case, the timestamp war, the now infamous 2:27 a.m. Google search, digital breadcrumb that the defense believes proves everything, despite there being evidence that they're just wrong, and that the prosecution argues proves nothing at all. The courtroom may have been quieter, but what played out during this part of the trial was arguably far more important. It was here, in a debate over the single Google search, that the entire architecture of the defense's framing theory learned, or their theory leaned forward like a house of cards, basically caught in a draft. And everyone, jury included, seemed to know it. The moment the phrase 2:27 a.m. left Alan Jackson's mouth, it was clear that we were what we were in for. This wasn't a cross-examination, it was a campaign. His target was a now infamous search query that had been recovered from Jennifer McCabe's phone and has since been debunked. The search read, "How's long to die in cold?" Misspelled and all. Timestamp 2:27 in the morning. It's more than 4 hours before John O'Keefe's body was found in the snow outside 34 Fairview Road. For the defense, this has always been their sharpest weapon. Till they look at their blade and go, "Oh, who's been trying to cut concrete with my kitchen knives? It's all nicked up and dull and doesn't work anymore." If McCabe was Googling how long it takes to die in the cold before the body was discovered, then by their theory, she must have known he was already out there. And if she knew that, maybe she knew why. Maybe she knew how. Jackson made that implication loud and clear. He laid the search out in front of the jury like it was a smoking gun, even calling it the most damning piece of evidence in this case. Isn't it, jury? He painted a picture in which Jennifer McCabe wasn't a friend reaching or reacting in horror, but an insider playing cleanup, searching the effects of hypothermia before first responders were even on the scene. It was meant to be devastating. She was doing all of this while also checking on basketball information for her daughter and then getting a couple hours of sleep. Like you do when your friend's dying on your front lawn. Yeah, that sounds believable. But here's the thing, timing is everything. And in this courtroom, the timing doesn't just come from human memory. It comes from digital forensic, things the defense of Karen Reed don't like. Because when you look a little bit deeper and you go, oh, that search wasn't done at 2:27 a.m. How? Well, let's take a look at how the data is constructed on the back end, the things you don't see on the front end. And suddenly, oh, we're wrong. Oh, well, they're wrong. I know you are, but what am I? McCabe didn't just deny the early morning search. She outright rejected the premise. Under oath, she testified that the query in question was made around 6:30 a.m., right after John O'Keefe's body was found, while she was standing with Karen Reed in the driveway. According to her, Reed was panicking, pulling at her, yelling at her to find out how long somebody could survive in the cold. McCabe said she grabbed her phone and typed in the query in a haze, barely remembering what the results even were. Her version of events put that search firmly after the discovery, not before. So how does a 6:30 a.m. search end up with 2:27 a.m. timestamp? Well, if you're one of the pink shirt-wearing free Karen Reed folks, this is where you want to cover your ears and go, la, 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 I don't hear this, I don't hear this, because it will be a narcissistic wound. Just warning you right now. But here's the reality. Enter Ian Whiffen. He's a digital forensic analyst, and his earlier testimony became essential to figuring out this exact puzzle. Whiffen explained how web activity is logged on iPhones, specifically how Apple's system logs browser tabs. According to him, the timestamp the defense is clinging to, like gospel, may not indicate when the search was made, but when the browser tab was last opened prior to that session. To prove the point, Whiffen ran a demonstration in court. He actually did this in court, so it's not up for debate. Well, that's theoretical. No, here's how it works, kids. Let me do this with the phone. Let me do this. Let me show you the timestamp. And still, even then, some folks have an amazing way of not accepting reality on reality's terms. I don't know how that is. I don't know why that is. I'm glad I don't believe that way. It sometimes seems like a funner place to live or more fun place to live because it seems a lot less dangerous and everything's a conspiracy and you're never wrong and everyone else is wrong and you can just interpret reality however you feel is fit. But sorry, facts matter. And it doesn't mean life is always a great thing. Sometimes you get it with information that contradicts what you want to believe, what you want to have be right. And sometimes you just kind of make those realizations that, oh, maybe I'm wrong. This does show that. I can reasonably see why I thought this first, but upon digging more and hearing from the guy who's with the company that interprets the actual data itself on the back end, and he's showing in court, not just through research, but literally a physical demonstration how this works. Sometimes you should yield to experts. We now live in a world where we don't do that, and everyone is an expert. He showed that if a Safari tab is opened at, say, 2:27 a.m. and then left open in the background, any later search in that same tab can show the earlier time as last viewed entry in the phone's logs. In layman terms, if the phone isn't showing you when the search was performed, it's showing you when the particular window was last brought into view, regardless of what was done inside it later. It's a subtle distinction, but it does matter a lot. If McCabe had opened her browser at 2:27 a.m. for any reason, including checking the weather, glancing at Facebook, whatever, when she was looking at basketball information, and then used that same search tab for how long to die in cold 4 hours later, the record might still reflect 2:27 a.m. Not because she made the search then, but because that's what the tab's start time is. This is not that complicated, kids. It's really not. It's either a matter of you don't want to believe the facts or you're incapable of believing the facts. Whiffen's analysis wasn't just theoretical. It was repeatable, testable, demonstrated, and it provided a clear, grounded explanation for what otherwise looked like damning evidence. In a case like this where so much hinges on digital footprints, that kind of testimony carries real weight. But Jackson wasn't about to let go. He brought up the fact that McCabe's browser history had been cleared shortly after the incident. That, he said, was suspicious. Why would she delete it if she had nothing to hide? McCabe answered plainly she didn't remember deleting anything, and if she had, it wasn't part of some coordinated effort. The forensic records don't show a wipe or scrub of her phone, just that browser cache had been cleared at some point. As many people do with their phones, glitchy, overloaded, or frankly, when they're in a mental fog. And Ian Whiffen also showed, he's the guy who knows the cell phones, there was no dog in this fight, that the phone deleted some of the history automatically. It's just what it was set to do. Clear up the cache, clear up the history. Didn't take an actual act of doing so. It's not proof. It's barely even a breadcrumb. Still, Jackson pressed. He tried to get McCabe to admit that the 2:27 a.m. search wasn't a fluke. He asked if she deleted the history because she knew it would implicate her. She denied it, clearly, firmly, and without any sort of question. Without equivocation. I never made that search at 2:27, she said. I never would have let John O'Keefe out in the cold to die because he was a friend that I loved. Let that sit for a moment. Because in this trial, that's the pulse running under everything. The defense is trying to reframe a night of confusion and tragedy as something premeditated and sinister. But what comes through again and again is how chaotic, frightening, and ultimately human those early morning hours were. A friend missing, a frantic search, cold, darkness, confusion. It's messy. It doesn't follow a script. But it's not necessarily malicious either. Whiffen's testimony doesn't say that McCabe is right or wrong. It doesn't clear her or condemn her, but it does provide an explanation rooted in how phones and browsers actually work. Not how we wish they did, or how someone who's not very advanced on these sort of things interpreted it. And because that initial interpretation works better with your theory, and the actual facts don't, doesn't mean you can keep sitting on that previous interpretation. It's wrong. It's like saying, oh, well, asbestos seems like this great product that will work wonderfully for everything. It's cheaper, it's better, it holds in heat, it's more efficient. Oh, it causes cancer and kills people? No. Well, the earlier study said it didn't, so bring on the asbestos. I don't need a mask. If this is how we work, it's also how we die. Because facts matter. Data matters. New education matters. In a courtroom where the defense has built so much on this one timestamp, that technical truth matters. You can't build a narrative on a foundation that's fundamentally misunderstood or fundamentally just ignored. By the time McCabe was excused from the stand later that morning, it was clear the 2:27 a.m. search wasn't the slam dunk the defense needed it to be. Yes, it does raise questions. But the answers, when provided by people who actually understand how digital systems operate, didn't support the idea that McCabe knew about O'Keefe's death hours before it happened. What they showed instead was that the defense had pinned much of its framing theory on a digital artifact that they misread. And let's be honest, once you need a forensic analyst to explain why your gotcha moment isn't actually what you think it is, that's not a great sign. Jennifer McCabe didn't flinch at this point. She maintained her account from start to finish. She didn't change her story under pressure. She didn't contradict herself. She admitted what she didn't know and stood by what she did. Wasn't flashy, but it was consistent. So when she finally stepped down, exhausted, shaken, but still standing, the case had reached a kind of pivot point. The defense had spent hours trying to bend her timeline into a confession. But in the end, what they really bent was the interpretation of a phone log. The jury watched all this unfold without a word. No visible reactions, no questions, just quiet faces taking it all in. Because while Jackson was working overtime to sell them a conspiracy, the prosecution had one more layer waiting. Something less subjective, less open to misinterpretation. What came next wasn't about emotions or browser tabs or group texts. It was about blood, numbers, and alcohol. The science of impairment. And how drunk Karen Reed really was the night John O'Keefe died. By the time the courtroom settled back in after lunch break, the atmosphere had shifted. The combative cross-examination of the mornings were over. The tension that had pulsed through Jennifer McCabe's final hours on the stand gave way to something colder, quieter, more methodical. This wasn't about memory or motive anymore. This was again about science, numbers, alcohol metabolism, and what those numbers said about Karen Reed on the night Officer John O'Keefe died. The prosecution called their next witness, Hannah Knowles, a forensic toxicologist with the Massachusetts State Police Crime Lab. If Jennifer McCabe's testimony was about emotional chaos, Knowles brought quite the opposite. Clean, measured, clinical. She took some of the information in and took to the stand, clearly accustomed to walking juries through the complex math of blood alcohol content, something most people only think about in the vaguest of terms, like whether they're okay to drive after a second glass of wine. But Knowles wasn't there to talk hypotheticals. She was there to explain, in no uncertain terms, just how much alcohol was in Karen Reed's system hours after the incident and what was likely in her hours before. She began by walking the jury through the actual data, a blood draw taken from Karen Reed at 9:08 a.m. on January 29th of 2022, the morning John O'Keefe was found dead. The toxicology report showed an ethanol concentration that translated to a blood alcohol content between 0.078 and 0.092. Now, that range straddles the legal limit in Massachusetts and most states, where 0.08 is the law. But as Knowles quickly explained, that number alone doesn't tell the whole story. And this was 9:07, 9:08 in the morning. 9:08 a.m. You're still drunk from the night before. But you only had those four drinks. Oh, then you added shots to them. And then you had the one drink with the three shots in it. And then you took a shot. And that's just what you're confessing to. Because we all know typically someone who drinks a lot or maybe has a problem, that number is usually deflated a lot when they talk about it out loud. So you're 9 hours past midnight and you're still there. Girl, that's probably at least 9 drinks, if not more. But hey, I know y'all don't like science. Because alcohol metabolizes over time, it burns off slowly but steadily as the body processes it. And that's where retrograde extrapolation comes in, a process forensic scientists use to estimate what someone's BAC would have been at an earlier point in time based on the known rate at which alcohol leaves the system. Knowles walked the court through the math, based on Karen Reed's BAC at 9:08 a.m. and according to and accounting for the hours that had passed since she was last believed to have been drinking around 12:45 a.m., Knowles testified that Reed's estimated BAC at that earlier time would have been significantly higher. Depending on variables like body weight, metabolic rate, drinking pattern, her BAC around 12:45 would have ranged anywhere from 0.14 to 0.28. That's not just over the legal limit. That's well into the zone. That's well into the zone where cognitive and motor impairments are not just possible. They're pretty much expected. According to Knowles, a BAC of 0.14 means slowed reaction times, poor decision making. Reduced coordination. At 0.28, you're looking at potential blackouts, confusion, and in some cases, even unconsciousness. It's not the kind of state where anyone should be behind the wheel of a vehicle, let alone in the middle of a snowstorm, navigating a narrow residential road at night. And it certainly is not a situation where, I remember everything! And then you proceed to tell like 7 different stories of how you remember everything. And when people go, those stories are all very different, Karen. You hate me. This is a witch hunt. No. Your own words are damning you. Knowles was careful not to editorialize this. She didn't speculate. She stuck to the data, explaining that even on the low end of her esteemed or estimated range, 0.14 Karen Reed would have been significantly impaired. And this wasn't conjecture. These were values supported by the toxicology findings and the principles of alcohol metabolism recognized in the field. It just is what it is. Now, the defense wasn't about to let that stand unchallenged, of course. Alan Jackson stood up for cross-examination, slammed a bottle of Everclear, and said, "Look, I'm fine," and then proceeded to take the bottle and smash it on Judge Beverly Cano's bench, saying, "Drink, bitch!" And then he passed out. No, I'm kidding. None of that happened. He pulled a rabbit out of a hat. No, it didn't happen either. Anyway, Alan Jackson stood up for cross-examination, and as expected, he zeroed in on the concept of retrograde extrapolation. He acknowledged the numbers, but tried to chip away at their certainty. He asked Knowles about the assumptions banked into her calculations. For example, what if Karen Reed had stopped drinking earlier than estimated? What if her body metabolized alcohol at a slightly faster rate than average? What if she was one of the Avengers? What if she was Superwoman? Would that bring the BAC estimate down? Knowles agreed in theory that there is some flexibility in the numbers. That's why the estimated range was given, not a single pinpoint value. But she didn't retreat from the conclusion. Even with the range as broad as it was, the lowest end, 0.14, was still nearly twice the legal limit. You could tweak the assumptions here and there, but you'd still end up with a woman who, scientifically speaking, was impaired. Jackson then tried another angle. He suggested that because the range was wide, 0.14 to 0.28, it left too much uncertainty. But again, Knowles didn't flinch. She reiterated that forensic toxicology always works within ranges because human physiology varies. But the important part wasn't the upper bound, it was the floor. And the floor was also dangerously high. Jackson then turned to the timing of the blood draw. Was 9:08 a.m. too late to rely on the results? Could something have happened in those hours between the incident and the tests that changed the results? Again, Knowles pointed back to the fundamentals. The BAC measured in the morning showed alcohol still is in Reed's system hours after the alleged incident. That suggests a high starting point. Unless she had a couple cocktails right before she left to go find John O'Keefe. Which I'm kind of surprised she didn't admit to that to try and cover this up. But hey, there's still time. While no calculation can be exact, the data and timeline supported the extrapolation as valid and the conclusion as credible. If Karen wanted to get out of that, she should have made up a story. She should have said, "I was up all night, I had a couple more drinks, and then we started looking for John." That would make it look, I guess, a little less bad. Still wouldn't look good. But in theory, you could argue that. But then if you add all the other known drinking that you did that night and the 42 versions of how you drank and the 7-minute explanation of how many you had, which I don't even know the exact number too, but it sure is high considering you're putting extra shots in every drink. Really, nothing would work out well here for you, Karen. You were drunk at the scene of a crime. Whether you knew it was a crime scene at that point in time or not, you were drunk. Driving a motor vehicle in which it looks like someone may have been struck by a motor vehicle. And somehow you want a jury to believe that all of his good friends decided to murder him and cover it up. Oh, and you have a cracked taillight. Oh, and his hair is on the taillight. But it must be his friends and Chloe, the German Shepherd, right? That makes sense. The jury, for their part, seemed especially attentive during this segment of the trial, unlike some of the more emotionally charged testimony, which had left them stone-faced or shifting uncomfortably in their seats. The forensic testimony had them leaning forward, eyes up. They weren't just being asked to believe a story. They were being asked to follow the science. Which they seem to like. Karen doesn't. That's where the prosecution came back in. On redirect, they reemphasized what had already been made plain, even under the most conservative scenario. Karen Reed's BAC at the time she allegedly drove away from 34 Fairview was well above the legal limit. That's not opinion, that is chemistry, and that is just a fact whether you like it or not. The significance of this testimony was hard to ignore because when you strip everything else away, the text threads, the driveway, the search history, the emotional chaos of the morning, what you're left with is this: a car, a dead man in the snow, and a driver whose blood showed she was legally impaired well into the next day. It wasn't about whether Karen Reed intended to harm John O'Keefe. It wasn't about whether she realized what had happened right away. It was about whether she was in a condition to be behind the wheel in the first place. And the numbers, cold, clinical, and indifferent to narrative, suggested she wasn't. The testimony from Hannah Knowles didn't draw gasps. It didn't end in fireworks, but the testimony landed like an anchor. Because in a case where so much has depended on what people remember or what they said or didn't say, it was a reminder that some things don't lie. Blood, alcohol, time. These don't care about loyalty or fear or reputation. They just are. And with that, the prosecution had laid another foundational stone in its case. They weren't just saying that Karen Reed killed John O'Keefe. They were saying that if she did, it happened while she was under the influence. And that this wasn't just an accident. It was potentially a crime of reckless behavior backed by measurable impairment. A conclusion not drawn from the bias, emotion, or interference, but from numbers written in ethanol and time. That's what you got. It was day 8. It's a lot more to come in this trial. Let me know in the comments what you think about how all of this went down. Again, we're grownups here, so we use big words, and we don't just say a couple words and insult people and run away. Okay? We don't do that. So you're welcome to argue anything. Just make it sane. That's all. I'm always amused when some of the first things that people say are like personal insults at people, like looks and things like that. Like, oh, I see we're coming from seventh grade. And it makes me wonder, what happened? What happened to you that this is how you argue and you're a grown ass adult? Some sort of trauma. And to those folks, I wish them well. I hope they do get the help that they need, because clearly being stunted doesn't work well in life. So I'm looking forward to seeing your responses. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. Or if you're watching this on YouTube, press subscribe there. So you don't miss any of our stories. We cover a lot of this here for you. Not just this case, but a whole lot more. My name is Tony Bruschi. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. We will talk again real soon.
Want to stay on top of the latest true crime cases? Press subscribe now and never miss a breaking update from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, how to best kill somebody with a knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.